The man who is the founding dean of the Harvard University Kennedy School for Government, Graham Allison, is with us. His new book, Destined for War, Can America and China Escape Thucydides' Trap? Only a Harvard man would use Thucydides in the subtitle of a book, Dr. Allison. How are you?
Thank you very much. I like your summary of the China challenge. And I think I agree with all the points you made so far, except for Thucydides. I think everybody should learn to pronounce Thucydides.
I know. Got it. Dr. Allison, before we get into your book, what do you think about Harvard rescinding acceptances to undergraduates based on what they claim are hateful memes in social media? What about that? They're now rescinding invitations to the university.
Well, I think it's there's been a lot of noise about it, but just to the bottom line, I regard the University of Chicago's note that the dean of students and then the president sent out as the right position, which is, if you're coming to a university, you're coming to a danger zone in which you're going to hear ideas that you may not agree with, some of them which will be deeply offensive. That's part of what's called an education, and the notion that there are safe zones or places where you're so sensitive about microaggressions that you restrain conversation, I think, makes no sense. And I say in my classroom, when I'm admitting students for a class where there's many more people who would like to take it than we have, I say, if you're coming into this class, just know we're equal opportunity offenders. This is like a professional conversation. So if you're easily offended or you have great sensitivities, this is not a class for you.
Well, I know. Here's the problem with the hateful memes analysis. I'm sure there's some rotten things put on Facebook and all these other social media outlets. I get it. I mean, I'm subjected to all this stuff. I don't even care, though. People say anything about me, it doesn't bother me one bit. But what's hateful to one person is smart to another. So one person says, well, we're against illegal immigration. We think it's destroying key sectors of our economy and key parts of our country. Is that hateful under Harvard standard? I mean, I guess it could be.
Well, fortunately, I'm not involved in the administration of it. And at least I only know about, the Kennedy School, and which I no longer am the dean of, but I'm a faculty member there, and I certainly know about the students and in my class. And I'd say that on the one hand, you don't want people to be offensive and ad hominem for its own sake.
Right.
So in my classroom, we're debating an issue just as you were suggesting, and some kid gets up and he attacks another person for being black or being Arab or being a southerner like I am or being whatever. I say to him, wait a minute, this is an ad hominem attack. Mm-hmm. If you want to attack the view that the person expressed, the view that either we should have a wall or we shouldn't have a wall, or we should attack China or we shouldn't attack China,
right,
or we should do this or we should do that. All those seem to me to be great and debatable issues. And the whole idea of education is that we contest with other people for ideas, and little by little, maybe we even learn something.
Yeah, I think that's the true meaning of university life, and open your mind to different ideas, have a vigorous debate.
Do that, but you have now, and actually, I mean, this is not my topic for today, but I would say you have a kind of a progressive ideology on some campuses, which basically says we've captured some truth and we want to promote this as our agenda. And I'd say that Harvard's motto is Veritas, which means searching for truth without the notion that anybody has actually captured the truth.
Yeah, I think what happens, and it's why I'm still a book person, I write books and I read books, there's this crazy idea that we're supposed to expand our pool of knowledge and expand our understanding as time goes on. Maybe it's with a deeper understanding of history. Maybe it's by talking with people from different backgrounds. But we actually can grow our brains as we get older. We can actually expand our understanding about things. So China is something.
I like that. Let me just give
yes.
you. Let me give you a footnote on that.
Yeah.
You may appreciate.
I love it when you footnote me. It's fun. Go ahead.
So, okay, you must get thousands of. Of emails, and I get hundreds of people who say, I'm investigating a subject, I want to talk to you. These are high school or college or other students. And my secretary, she now knows to give them a number one. That's the response that says, there's an Professor Allison is not able to talk to you, but he does have some great advice for you. There's an amazing way of learning answers to questions like the one you raised. It's called reading.
Yeah, you know what? They want you to do their work on their paper for them. So they're like, Professor, tell us about this. Oh, my God. That's hilarious. You know, this is where I'm upset I didn't go to the Kennedy School to take your class. We got to talk about your book.
There's still room.
Oh, there's still room. Can I Skype in, Professor? Would a lowly Dartmouth College graduate be even admitted to the Kennedy School of Government?
You can be like Bill O'Reilly. You jump in late and get your degree late.
Well, oh, I could get my degree late at Harvard. Why not?
Exactly.
Hey, Professor, the book is fascinating. It's called Destined for War, as I said, and it's about the relationship we have with China. And I've been obsessed with China. I've never been, and I guess I'm desperate to go. But
you should go.
I'm desperate to go. I don't know if they'll let me in, but I'm desperate to go. But you write in the middle of your book, and I'm skipping around here, but in the middle of the book, you talk about the ways that we could avoid war with China, because we're the two biggest military powers in the world, two of the wealthiest powers in the world. And you talk about how we could undermine the regime in China with, you know, what we did a lot with the Soviet Union. We didn't trade with the Soviet Union. We ultimately brought them to their knees, peace through strength, Ronald Reagan, SDI, a lot of the Harvard protests against SDI, as I remember, professor, doctor,
right.
Excuse me. Your last way to avoid war is about redefining our relationship. Can you talk to us about that?
Well, let me say two things. First, the big idea in the book is Thucydides' trap. So Thucydides is a mouthful, and it's hard to say sometimes, but in any case, this was the father of history. And in his first book of recorded history, he said it was the rise of Athens and the fear that this instilled in Sparta that accounted for the war that brought these two great states of classical Greece to their knees. So basically, when you have a rising power threatening to displace a ruling power, you have deep structural stress that allows events that would otherwise be external, like in North Korea, or easily manageable, to produce cascades of actions and reactions, at the end of which nations that never intended to go to war and that knew that war would be crazy ended up finding themselves in a war. Think about how we got into World War I. So with the assassination of an archduke who nobody cared about, in Sarajevo by a Serbian terrorist, you know, if you were doing a novel, couldn't make this up, became the spark that produced the fire that burned down all the houses of Europe. So at the end of the First World War, every one of the leaders who was acting in 1914 had lost what he cared about most. The Austro-Hungarian emperor was trying to hold together his empire. Mm-hmm. The empire is dissolved and he's gone. The Russian czar is trying to back the Serbians. His whole regime has been overturned by the Bolsheviks, the communists. The Kaiser in Germany is trying to back his buddy in Vienna. He's tossed out. France has been bled of its youth for a whole generation. Society never recovers. And Britain has been turned into a debtor, though it's been a creditor for 100 years, and it's in terminal decline. So at the end of the war, if you'd given people a chance for a do-over, nobody would have chosen what he did. But they made their choices, and the war came. So I think in this case, looking at the relationship between U.S. and China, there's no question, and I urge you to go to China. I just think you can't believe what has happened there. It's just different.
I can. They have a lot of our money over there. I can exactly believe what they're doing. They got a lot of our money.
They have a huge amount of our money. They also have taken, I was in a presentation yesterday here. I'm in L.A., and a guy said, look, let me just remind you what's happened in Shanghai. There's 4,000 buildings more than 25 stories in New York City. There's 40,000 buildings more than 25 stories in Shanghai.
Yeah.
So you say, whoa, wait a minute. So this is something that we've never seen before and never as a nation risen so far, so fast in so many different dimensions, and much of it at our expense. So that's absolutely right. So to jump to the question, could you imagine the U.S. and China figuring out some way to look at the things, the interests they have in common, and work on those? For example, for sure, we don't want a nuclear war because we could kill all of each of us. Mm-hmm. So that's crazy. In the economic arena, there are areas where we could have great mutual advantage. And there's no question that since China's joined the WTO, it's had this fantastic growth. But again, much of that has come at our expense, including huge theft of U.S. intellectual property, which they haven't been punished for. Well, I would say that's been a dumb arrangement. We haven't worked that out very well.
Can I read a part of your professor? I know I'm a student here, but I'm going to interrupt for just a moment.
Please.
you talked about that.
You're the host. So.
You talked about global trade and in on page 230, you talked about you know, how the pie is divided. The pie of with global trade investment,
right.
Larger pie, bigger pieces for both nations. But then you add, despite their many differences, the U.S. and China have a common interest in managing these rising forces, this forces of and you list them, a surge of populism, nationalism, and xenophobia, ensuring that they do not unravel the fabric of the global economy. Now, that you seem to stand more in this section of your book for the global economy than you do for the nation state and for the sovereign free people of whatever country we happen to be talking about. And anytime I see someone throw their favorite triplets together, populism, nationalism, and xenophobia, it's like a trigger warning. It's like a trigger warning on campus. I'm like, all right, they don't like me. So what about that?
Well, I think President Trump would say it's complicated. Okay, and that the answer is yes. Lots of things are complicated. So, I believe in the, and I think economics has demonstrated over the last, you know, whatever, 200-300 years. Today, we are how many times richer than people were 100 years ago? You know, multiple.
All right, but let's go back 20 years.
1,000 years ago.
20 years, we're poor. We're poorer than we were 20 years ago. China's richer. What's happened in 20 years?
No, we're relatively poorer than we were. We're still a lot richer. The GDP has continued to grow, just at a very slow rate. China's grown at a much faster rate. So
right.
China has benefited more from the arrangements than we have. But the basic point, to go back to the question, is a trading arrangement, as Adam Smith taught us, in which you take the things you can make better than I do, and I take the things I can make better than you do, and we trade, allow both of us to have a bigger pile of things than we would if we each just tried to live on our own. So if you can grow bananas and I can make computers, and you can grow bananas a lot better than I can, and I can make computers better than you can, if we trade bananas and computers, we'll both have more. That doesn't say how you divide the pie. So the pie grows by trade. The question of how then the larger pie gets divided, now is a competitive thing between you and me. So we have to argue about that. And I would say, one of the things that's happened over the past 20 years is China has gotten a bigger chunk of a bigger pie. I'm for the bigger pie, but I'm also for a bigger chunk.
Yeah, I think that the problem always is, in the end, is we got a lot of people that need jobs, and a lot of high school graduates who don't go to college or don't want to go to college, maybe trade school, they can't support their families. So the pie, the bananas, the computers, all that's an academic, and it's an interesting conversation, but we still have people, and China's still a communist country, and they're still taking down crosses off of churches and putting people in camps who disagree with them. And that's, you know, anyway, I love having Professor Allison on. The book, Destined for War, fascinating. We'll have him back on The Laura Ingraham Show.
The Laura Ingraham Show.